This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lay on the eagle boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the lay line there.
Welcome once again to all my dear podcast listeners. Thanks again for joining us. It's great to have you along for another two-part edition that sees us delve into the sailing life of yet another sailing great. And this edition, well, you obviously know who it is already. I can safely promise you two editions of Sailing Insight from one of the very top names in the sport. To all of you that got in touch after listening to the very wonderful John Bertrand, many, many thanks. Your support, as always, it means a lot. It's great to know how and where you listen to the podcast. And if you like the chat with John, and you haven't already checked out the very successful Untold series of films on Netflix, take a look at their Race of the Century film. It's a fascinating look at that 1983 America's Cup win, as told in great detail in John's podcast, but with great archive footage and some revealing interviews with his teammates, some of whom you may well have heard on this podcast as well. So check it out. But not yet. Keep listening. You are in for a treat. Before we get going, a quick word about supporting the podcast. If you like what we do, please do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. Leave us a message and buy us a coffee or two. Whatever you think reflects the amount of enjoyment you get from tuning in. It makes a difference. So if you've already done so this season, then many thanks. But if you haven't, then wherever you are, help us keep the pod free from random ads by showing your support. Thank you. So back to our guest this month. And if you're a fan of any of the high-end Grand Prix sailing series of the past decade, this sailor's achievements will not be new to you. In fact, there can be few sailors who have spread their success in the sport as wide as this month's guest. To illustrate this, if we take a brief look at winners of the World Sailor of the Year awards, there's a few sailors who've won that prestigious award multiple times. All absolute legends of the sport. But winning it multiple times over the span of over a decade, well, that's almost unique. Only two people have done that. One, of course, is multiple award-winning Sir Ben Ainslie, and the other is our guest this month, Australian great Tom Slingsby. At one point in this podcast, Tom even talks about the awards and why he holds them in such high esteem. He's modest about his achievements, but forthright and honest too. We talk about his Olympic career, how at the start of his journey he famously listed the things he would achieve and about the efforts involved in achieving them. He's won the America's Cup. He's the only skipper to have won SailGP's elusive $1 million first place prize, and so much more besides. We talked to Tom earlier this year while in the UK after competing at the British SailGP Regatta. Since then, he's consolidated his Australian team spot at the top of the SailGP Season 3 rankings. But he's also signed with America's Cup team, American Magic. All of which we discuss over the coming chat. I hope you enjoy the time I spent with Tom Slingsby.
That final where Ben Ainslie match raced Robert Scheidt to the gold, I said right then and there that I want to be a part of this arena. I was writing down my goals for my career, and every time I achieved one, I ticked it off and I had it on my wall for years and years. You learn a lot more from your losses than you do from your wins, and it'll all make sense soon. And I remember just thinking, oh, what a load of crap.
Tom, you've been a guest on the podcast before. It was a short chat about your time chasing Olympic medals, but there is just so much more to discuss. It's great to have some time with you now, a proper sit-down chat about all things Tom Slingsby. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Shirley.
Well, we're meeting in a rather lovely library of a London hotel. A very short breather for you as you bounce through London. You're on your way back from SailGP in Plymouth. Before that, you were with the TP52 fleet in picking up your first regatta win for Team Phoenix. Is it fair to say that it's all going rather well, Tom?
Yeah, my sailing has been going really well lately. Over the last couple of years, I've managed to sail with amazing teams, get some amazing results. With obviously SailGP and sailing with those guys for so long, we've been successful. And then the TP52 class, I'm fortunate to have joined Hasso and Tina Plattner's Phoenix team. And they're just a great group of people. I just really enjoy sailing with them. And so it was really nice to pick up the first win for that team last week down in Palma. So it's and then I guess I haven't been doing too much of my own personal sailing in the Moth and stuff lately, but every time I jump in those boats, I love it. So I'm in a really good place in my sailing career at the moment. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, we can tell. Talk to us a bit about Plymouth. Before the racing, Tom, I saw a great picture of you talking in the cockpit with the Duchess of Cambridge. It looked like you were talking her through some tactics. I hope she was concentrating.
She's actually very knowledgeable. It's not her first time around these sort of foiling boats. I remember she came to a World Series event in Plymouth, America's Cup World Series event. And I was just sort of explaining a bit about how the wheel works and all the functions on the wheel, how we can control the flight of the boats and different things like that. But she was prompting me in a lot of questions, and she definitely knew what was going on. And a huge honour to meet her. I think that's the third or the fourth time I've met her. I've been fortunate with America's Cups and SailGP, but she got out there, had a great sail. I think she beat the Kiwis in their Commonwealth race, and it's such a great to have someone like her supporting SailGP. That's big for us.
We have a lot of sailors in the royal family, so it's great that they came to see the action. On the water, Tom, consistency in the fleet seems pretty hard to come by. I mean, this weekend you suffered some technical issues, but worse than that, in front of Her Royal Highness, you penalised the home favourite, Sir Ben Ainslie, out of the three-boat superfinal, just 100 metres from the finish line.
We did. I had to get out of Plymouth pretty quickly last night. I don't think I was a crowd favourite. And even this morning at the train station, a few people came up to me and gave me a bit of a hard time. And my girlfriend made me put on my sunglasses and hat on and just sort of go in disguise a little. But it's one of those tricky ones. We're racing, and it doesn't matter who it is. I would have done the same thing. I guess being Ben Ainslie and racing in the UK, he's a god here. And to knock him out of the final podium race, I wasn't a fan favourite at all.
I think the British fan has got used to seeing him do it to other people, Tom.
I can guarantee you, if the shoe was on the other foot, he would have done it 10 out of 10 times. Doesn't matter if it was in Sydney or the UK, Ben's the most aggressive sailor I've ever sailed against, and he would never, ever let an opportunity like that go to waste. So, I did what he would do to me, and it was unfortunate I knocked them out of the final. Well, for the British fans, not for us, because we gained another point in the overall season. But that's racing. And I had one person on my social media giving me a bit of stick this morning about that. And I almost replied with a comment saying, hate the game, not the player. Because if the jury are going to give those penalties, we're going to go for them.
We love the drama. It's great. Tom, we're going to talk all things SailGP and the America's Cup a little later. But first, we're delving back into those formative years. You grew up just north of Sydney with your twin sisters. What was that like, and how much was sport part of the young Tom Slingsby's upbringing?
For me, sport was everything, I guess. I wasn't an academic at school. I tried, but I was never... Even going to university and stuff, I would have struggled through. It didn't come easily to me. Sport, I wouldn't say came easily to me, but I loved it. And I didn't have to, it wasn't hard work for me to go practice. And so my mother was right into tennis. She played tennis a lot and followed tennis. And my dad was a sailor. He was formerly a bit of a professional sailor. He did a lot of Sydney Hobart races and a lot of big events in sailing. And my twin older sisters started in tennis and sailing as their two main sports. And I just naturally followed. I guess shortly after, tennis became a priority at about 6 or 7 years old. We realised I had a bit of talent, and we really pursued that hard for about 10 years until I burnt out in tennis, and I decided that sailing was a sport for me.
You're renowned for your competitive nature. When you look back, where do you think that drive came from? I mean, were you always trying to beat your sisters at everything?
Yeah, well, in sailing, my sisters were definitely better. And actually, one of my sisters, Alana, was much better in tennis as well. I don't know where it's honestly something I was born with, I guess, that competitive nature. I had a very fiery temper in tennis as well. And I used to break a few rackets when I was young. And I think the worst thing that ever happened to me was getting a sponsorship for tennis rackets, and that meant I could sort of had no excuse not to break them. And my mum really came down on me hard when I used to lose my temper and break rackets. And it's something I've always had, is a bit of a fiery temper. And it only ever happens on the sporting field, in sailing or in tennis. But I've relaxed a lot over the years, but still, for sure, on the water, when something doesn't go my way, I can fire up.
How big a deal was sailing in those early years?
Sailing wasn't big for me when I was young. From the age of sort of 5 to 15, I did sailing one day a week, and I probably did tennis 5 to 6 days a week. I used to train in tennis before school, after school, twice a day, 5 to 6 days a week. And then on Saturday afternoons was my sailing day. As a junior sailor, I wasn't very good. I used to sort of compete against good friends of mine, Joe Turner and Nathan Outridge, who were the top dogs. They used to win every Sabo event we used to go to, and they were the juniors, and I never got close to them. I still remember the first time I beat them. I beat them both in my first race at the same time, but I didn't really understand it. It was a teams racing championship. And I was paired with Joe Turner from Gosford Sailing Club, competing against Nathan Outridge from Wanji. And Joe Turner said that, look, Tom, you're not very good, so you just go for the finish line and I'll worry about Nathan. And I remember I just went for the finish line, and they're match racing, doing circles and all sorts of things. And I beat them across the line, and I just started yelling at them, "I beat you, sucked in. I finally beat you. It's been 10 years and then Nathan and Joe are like, "What are you talking about? It's a teams race." Like, Joe's like, "We're on the same team. You didn't beat me. We're a team." And I said, "No, I beat you." And that was my... So I wasn't a top junior sailor in it by any means, but I guess that sort of changed when I quit tennis and I had a lot of time on my hands and I decided to dedicate it to sailing.
I bet Nathan Outridge never lets you forget that. That's so funny.
Yeah, no, he's brought it up a few times.
You were in your teens, Tom, when the Sydney Olympics came to town. And it's such an amazing venue, isn't it? The amphitheatre of Sydney Harbour, full of Olympic excitement. What are your memories of that time?
It was unbelievable. For me, I guess by this stage, I was 15 years old and I had already decided that I wanted to be an athlete of some sort, whether it was tennis or sailing or something else. I knew that I wanted to do that, but I remember we got given 2 weeks holidays off school for the event, and that allowed me, I was from around an hour and a half north of Sydney, to jump on two trains and a bus and come down and sit on Bradley's Head on the Sydney Harbour shoreline and watch the sailing. And I was just getting into my laser sailing at the time, so Michael Blackburn was my hero, and he's going up against these legends of Ben Ainslie and Robert Shite, and who was going to win, the hometown favourite or the legends of Ben Ainslie and Robert Shite. And I was just sort of absolutely captivated by that battle. And I felt like, even though Michael couldn't hear me and didn't know who I was, I felt like me coming down and supporting on the rocks of Bradley's head every day would make a difference. So I was there every day that he raced and, yeah, supporting. But just seeing the Olympic arena, I just, in that moment, I mean, as the story goes, in that moment, watching that final where Michael Blackburn took the bronze and Ben Ainslie match race Robert Scheidt to the gold, I said right then and there that I want to be a part of this arena. I want to go and win a gold medal for Australia. And I just started selling lasers. And so I said, in the laser class, that's it. That's what I have to do.
It had a massive influence, didn't it, on the young Tom Slingsby?
It did. Well, it sort of gave me purpose, I guess. I just quit tennis, and I just, because of my whole junior life, I was going to be a professional tennis player. And I realized that wasn't going to be the case. And I decided to, and right then and there, I just remember I was on the train on the way home, and I was writing down what I'm going to do, my goals for my career, and I'm going to win a gold medal for Australia. How do I do that? And it started with winning the club champion, the Laser Radial Club Championship at Gosford Sailing Club, then the Coast Championships, then the Metropolitan Championships, State Championships, National Championships, World Championships, and eventually a gold medal in the laser class. And every time I achieved one, I ticked it off, and I had it on my wall for years and years. And it just gave me motivation, purpose, and I guess a dream. And I wonder if I could actually achieve this, and dedicated my life to it right then and there.
I've got to just add something, a slight side note. If Michael Blackburn is listening, I'll never forget, we both finished fourth in Atlanta, and we sat next to each other on the bus on the way home from the final race and said, yeah, how did you get on? I was fourth. How did you get on? I was fourth. And I was so delighted in Sydney then when he was on the podium. It was a really, really special moment. And he went on to be the most incredibly talented coach.
My story with Michael's, a pretty amazing one to me at least, but yeah, as I said, he was my hero. He was he was the guy I wanted to be like, and I was cheering for him. And then when I decided I'm going to go for the Olympics, he became, I guess, a rival, and he beat me in the 2004 Olympic trials. And then he became even more of a rival, it was head to head with him for the 2008 Olympics. We were friendly, but it was definitely full on for who was going to get the Olympic spot, which I eventually was given in 2008. And then in 2009, he became my coach. So he went from hero to rival to coach, and now he's like a mentor to me. So our sort of evolution has been a really good one, and he's a very close friend to this day.
As you say, your first shot at the Olympics came in China in 2008, in the laser, of course, and you'd made huge strides. You'd won the Worlds in Portugal the year before. You were fourth in the test event, which is always a good measure a year out from the big regatta. How confident were you going into your first games?
Extremely confident, overconfident. I think I was about 22 years old. I just won the previous two world titles. So the world titles in 2008 were in February, and then that year I don't think I lost an event, whether it was Palmer, Hiers, Medemblik, the Europeans I won. And I don't think I'd lost an event in over 9 months, and I don't think I'd been off the podium, other than fourth in the pre-Olympics, I don't think I'd been off the podium in probably close to 2 years. So for me, in my mind, it wasn't are you going to win a medal, is what colour am I going to get? And even then I was adamant I was going to win a gold medal. And I don't know, I sort of had relied on that belief the whole time. And even when things weren't going my way, I was just sort of, no, I'll overcome this. It's not a problem. I'll push through it. But that's not the way it went. The result shows I was 22nd and I was the favourite. I remember, I think it was Inside Sport in Australia did an article on, it was Australian athletes to bet the house on. and I was a $1.10 favourite to win the gold medal there. And I finished 22nd, so it's a pretty bad choke.
What are your memories of that tricky Olympic regatta?
I remember arriving and for sure my headspace wasn't right. I had been losing so much weight. So from the moment I sort of qualified and then we had a world title in February, and then straight after that I said, now I've got to lose all the weight. And I walked around at about 87 kilos, I'd say. And then the weight loss had to start, and I got down to about 78 kilos a few months out from the games. And I remember a doctor saying, you've got to stop losing weight. You're now going to be burning into muscle and it's going to get really tough for your body, your immune system, everything. And I took that as another challenge and as someone telling me I can't do something. And that's what motivated me more than anything. And so I ignored the doctor and I kept losing weight. My morning run at home in Australia was a 26-kilometre loop, and I'd get home and scull water and sleep, and then I'd wake up and go sailing. I didn't do it the right way. I wasn't a big salad eater or vegetable eater, and so I just basically starved myself. So I remember arriving at the Olympics and I was mentally a bit weird, but I just won the Europeans the week before and I was like, I can still pull this together. And then the boat arrived and supplied equipment in the laser. And I remember I wasn't happy with my boat at all. I felt it was slow. The rake was wrong. It wasn't the same as the other boats, the other people that were getting supplied equipment. I remember complaining about it and they said, look, there's nothing wrong with the boat. You've got to leave it. And, so my boat speed wasn't good. And I think that I made it into such a big thing in my mind, and because I wasn't thinking too clearly, it sort of developed into such a big thing. In hindsight, the boat was probably just as good as anyone else's, but in my mental state, I made it into something much larger than it was, and basically I couldn't solve simple boat speed problems. Like if I was struggling for height, the usual fix might be maybe a little more out haul off, moved my weight forward a little bit, in the boat, sit in a bit more heel, a couple of little things that I'll usually be very analytical about and solve the problem. I remember looking up at the sail and looking at the boat and just going, I don't know what else to do. I can't solve these problems. So I really look back at those Olympics and just say, well, I lost way too much weight, and that just drove everything. It drove me not being able to fix my boat speed problems. It drove me to not being mentally able to come back from a bad first few races. It drove a lot of things. And I'll sort of remember that. And I took that, it took a long time, but I went away from those Olympics as thinking that's a huge lesson there. Now your body is so important, and your fitness and your health and your mind, and if you don't have that in place, you're not going to be able to compete at a high level.
How difficult was life post-games? I mean, how tough was it having had such expectations to finish then so far off the podium?
It was actually really, really tough, and mentally I actually wasn't in the greatest space apart from the weight loss. I just wasn't really happy in myself. Even though I was winning all these events, world titles and stuff, I still wasn't a very happy person, I think. It took me about 4 or 5 months until I sort of let it go a bit. I didn't let it go. I really wanted to learn the lessons from it. I remember Viktor Kovalenko coming up to me after and saying, you won't believe me right now, but you learn a lot more from your losses than you do from your wins, and it'll all make sense soon. And I remember just thinking, oh, what a load of crap. Like, I don't want to hear that. And it was only months later that I realized that actually I can really use this motivation for good. And yeah, I think it was about sort of 6 or 7 months later, I said, okay, time to get back in the boat and start climbing the hill again. But it was tough because I'd won world titles, European titles, every single grade one event in sailing, in the laser. So the only to do another 4 years, and I had to wait 4 years to have the shot at the one event I hadn't won. It was tough, but I sort of built into it and took 2009 very easy, and then 2010 I started ramping things up.
In my own experience, finishing a devastating fourth in Atlanta, I mean, it really set me up for a real radical rethink about my approach to the whole thing. You know, with a bit of hindsight now, you know, how much motivation did your experience in China give you as you prepared for London?
It was huge. Yeah, it was. I knew that I just couldn't rely on talent anymore, that I had to be much more professional, and I had to tick all the boxes, as the cliche goes. But in 2009, I paired up with Michael Blackburn, and there's not a more professional person in sailing. This guy, Blackers, thinks of absolutely everything. And we said, okay, you've got these demons in your head about the boats being not equal and unfair, so let's delve right into that. So we started measuring every boat we could get our hands on, and would measure mast, rake, boat weight and everything. And then we would say, okay, this is what you like to sail with, a mast rake of 38-15, boat weight of 57 kilos or under, all these things. And then, but what do you do if you get a 60 kilo boat and a 38-35 mast rake that's way forward? And then we started basically trying to get those boats. We'd buy them secondhand off people and say, we want your boat, how much? And we started training in those boats, and I got my ass kicked for so long until I learned the characteristics of each boat. I learned with the heavy boat and the wrong mast rake, I couldn't do what I called my low mode upwind, sailing low and fast. I had to stay in a high mode. I had to move my weight different place on the hiking strap for different conditions. I had to change the sail shape, more outhaul, more depth, different things like that. And then all of a sudden we started winning with these bad boats. And then, and then basically every time we'd get a new boat, we would learn the characteristics, write it down in Blacker's plot, and we became super analytical and professional on every single boat. We know how to make go fast now. So when I arrived to the Olympics in 2012, we just go, okay, this is some measurements, this is some mast rake, boat weight, and we had this boat 2 years ago in Lake Garda, and this is how we got it to the front of the fleet. And that's what happened. And so all of a sudden these sort of demons in my head about not being able to make the boat go fast were gone. And then I guess I just sort of had to battle the scars of 2008 and being the favourite and choking. That was the next hurdle.
That's incredible attention to detail. I mean, I didn't know that story at all. And I mean, I'm sure that's Olympic sailing, isn't it? It's all about, you have time for that level of attention to detail. But I'm sure some of our sailing fans who are listening to this are going to be quite surprised by that level and that workload.
Yeah, and it went through everything. That was just the boat. And then it might have been light air chop upwind sailing. Black has said, look, these are your weaknesses. I know you don't like to hear it, but you need to work on this. And he used to just make me train all the time in the things I wasn't good at, and which was light air. Light air conditions was always my weakness. And he said, we've just got to sail in this more than anyone. And yeah, all of a sudden I used to be that young kid who'd just go, oh, the wind, it's under 10 knots. I don't want to train. I'll wait for the 20 knots and then go out there and blast past everyone. And Blackers was just like, look, we know you can beat them in 25 knots. What's the point? I said, but you don't know that you can beat them in 7 knots. So, and we just started training nonstop in that. And all of a sudden I was taking my rest days and the 20 knot days, which was a bit unheard of for me at that time. And really concentrating on the light air, and it really turned me into an all-rounder. And I really learned from Blackers. He taught me how to be, that there's levels to this sport, and talent will only get you so far, and you've got to be professional if you want to be up there with the top guys.
Well, the process really worked, didn't it? I mean, you dominated that quad. Three times world champion, won the test event at the Olympic venue. You were World Sailor of the Year in the build-up in 2010. But always knowing things don't always go to plan. How confident were you as the London event kicked off?
I was as confident as I could be, I guess, in my personal prep. I knew that boat speed, it doesn't matter if it's light winds, strong winds, doesn't matter what the conditions throw at me. But I guess I had this mantra going into it, and I would have said it 100 times in the press, was if I do what I know I can do, no one will beat me. And so for me, I took away my rivalry with Paul Goodison. I took away my worrying about different competitors in different conditions. I just fully put the focus on me. And I just literally started looking at everyone as a boat. And I didn't even put a face to the boat. And I just said, if I do what I know I can do, no one can stick with me. You're not going to hang with me. And it especially sort of applied when it got windy and it got hard and the going got tough and we're all in pain in the laser, hiking up the last beat in 20 knots. And I used to always just look at the boat next to me and say, I'll go through so much more pain than you will, and I know I'll break you here. And so I had that mindset, but I just hadn't been able to, as something I couldn't prepare for was, I guess, the demons of 2008. And how I was going to deal with that on day one. On day one of the Beijing Olympics, I had a 21st and 22nd. And I remember, and then day two, I had a 21st, 22nd. And I've just remember like that. I've probably had that nightmare 100 times. And it still haunts me this day, I guess. But when I hit the start line, in the first race of the Olympics, I just kept telling myself I'm not the same person, and if I go out there and do what I know I can do, no one's going to stop me. And breeze was up a bit, which I guess helped my confidence. And I think I went out and had a first and a second on day one, and then and there I think I put it all to bed. The sort of that this isn't I'm not the same person I was. I did go through a bit of a mid-regatta hiccup where I started scoring a bit higher points, and the Cypriot Pavlos Kantidos overtook me at about, I'm not sure, race 7 or 8 of the championship, 10 race series, and I'd led the whole way, and then I got overtaken. But I went out and I ended up winning the last 3 races of the qualifying, and I just, yeah. I was super, super confident heading into the last day.
Talk to me about that medal race. I mean, how you said you were confident. What were you feeling going into that?
I was actually feeling a bit of, a bit of relief because, and I know this sounds stupid with how competitive and ruthless I was, but I was really happy that Pavlos Kantidos couldn't lose second place. It's a tricky one in our sport with the medal race scenario, and Paul Goodison had it 4 years earlier where he was, I think, 17 points ahead of second place, and so mathematically it's possible for him to lose a gold medal. But then the second place might only be 2 points ahead of third or fourth, or and so Paul ended up match racing Rasmus Mygren and putting him into fourth place in the, I think, fourth or fifth in the Olympics in 2008. And I remember thinking that's like the worst position to be in, where you've got to win your gold medal and the way you do it is to take someone out, but you're taking away their dream. And I remember with Pavlos, he mathematically couldn't lose it. He was going to be the first ever medalist for Cyprus in any sport, and so I remember thinking to myself, he's so happy no matter what, so I'm gonna hammer him. And so the whole goal was just not let him breathe, and from the 4 minute gun I'm gonna be on him. And I'd done a lot of match race practice with Michael Blackburn in the years prior, and And Tom Burton was now my training partner, and he was extremely good. And I remember just thinking, I'm just not going to let him breathe. And that's kind of what happened. I was just all over him at the start, and then we both tacked off, and he actually was going a little quicker than me up the first speed. And I was like, oh God, if he crosses me here, my whole plan goes out the window. But I managed to get a lee bow in and managed to pull forward, and then got ahead of him on the next cross. And it looked pretty harsh, because obviously he had to win the race and me finish seventh or worse. And we're in last and second last, and I just wouldn't let him go. And everyone's probably thinking, oh, he's not going to go on and win the race from here. But I just was never going to take that chance. I had to put him to the back of the fleet, and that's what I had to do to win a gold medal.
Can you remember crossing the line knowing that you'd done enough? Describe what that felt like.
It's pretty emotional to think about it, actually, because it was a long, hard journey for me, and made so much harder by 2008. And I just remember thinking, I still remember it. I just remember thinking, it's over. It's over. Like, because it just felt like I just had to get to the top of the hill, and then now it's downhill from here. Like, the whole battle's done. And it was just relief. And yeah, it's like I've remember hearing, I think, Ben, and I remember Ian Percy, and so many of the gold medalists you've had on, and everyone says it's relief. And that's exactly what it was for me. You put so much pressure on yourself for so long, and it just feels like the battle's over. You can relax now. You can finally not get up at 5 a.m. and go cycling in the rain, and you can finally just relax, and you've done it. You've achieved your dream. And it was the biggest moment for me by far in my sporting career. And everyone sort of asks, how's it compare with like different titles, America's Cups or all that? And even though we won the America's Cup in amazing circumstances, nothing will ever compare to the gold medal, just because the journey was so long and so tough. I don't know how we convinced them to allow the Australians to take over this pub, but it was the greatest thing. We had a spy down in New Zealand. They said, it's real. I've seen it. They're going downwind at over 30 knots. The boat started disintegrating, breaking apart, and getting pulled out underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. And oh, what an ordeal for my first day sailing the boat.
Your medal was one of many for the Aussie Olympic team, top sailing nation in 2012. I mean, they owned Weymouth, and in particular, the Cove Pub. It's one of my favourite London memories, heading there in the evening to interview the Aussie medalists. It's nestled in the corner of Chesil Beach, and there was extraordinary scenes there. Every Aussie news crew reporting from the beach into early morning Australian breakfast telly. And a little bit of Australia on Portland. It was a special time, wasn't it? And with an exceptional team.
It really was. I look back at that time with such fond memories. Some of my best friends in the world, with Nathan Goobs and just traveling the world with those guys and competing. And we had a similar story. Nathan almost got the gold medal in Beijing and missed it. And for the next 4 years, myself, Nathan Goobs, was kind of inseparable. We sort of made a pact to sail every type of boat we could. Let's sail A-classes and all sorts of types of moths and the whole bit. And we went on that real campaign together, even though we're in different classes. We were a really tight group of, the Australian team was really tight that time around, with Matt Belcher, Malcolm Page as well, and the Matt Tracing girls doing so well, and Brendan Casey in the Finn, he was kind of like our sort of ringleader, and he might not have got a medal, but he was kind of a big brother to us all. And then somehow we managed to convince the Cove Inn to be our partner for friends and family. And obviously the sailors are in the Olympic Village, and that became our meeting point to see our friends and family who have travelled from Australia, and to go there, sit there, have dinner with them, have a drink with them, and we'd head there most nights. And And I remember when it started, I'd go see my parents down there and would have a drink, and then the next day there was more people, and then more people, and then all of a sudden I remember thinking, there's so many people there. I don't need that drama. I'm just gonna go hang in the village and have a quiet dinner. But I don't know how we convince them to allow the Australians to take over this pub, but it was the greatest thing. Well, for me, it was the greatest thing ever after I'd finished my event, because it just became this party pub that the Australians had taken over, and the atmosphere. Every time you walked into it, everyone's laughing, smiling, beers in hand, and singing and all sorts of things. And we were about 5 or 6 times over capacity. People are spilled out onto the sidewalk and out onto the beach, and it was just an amazing atmosphere at that pub. So yeah, if they're listening, thank you again, because everyone talks to me. Anyone who was at those Olympics talked to us about the Cove Inn and what a special spot it was.
Yeah, it was so good. And of course the Aussie swimmers had a terrible games, didn't they? So all the Aussie media made the trek to Portland and hung out at the Cove pub.
They did. I didn't know it at the time, but I mean, obviously we were following the Aussies' results in the Olympics, but I didn't really realise that we hadn't won an individual gold medal at this stage. And then all of a sudden all the media came down for my medal race. I'm like, this is a bit overkill, isn't it? Like, we always win gold medals, and we'd won a couple of relay gold medals, but it was a real, I guess, gold medal drought for Australia. We were favourite to win in multiple swimming categories, and they didn't get it. And so all of a sudden they're like, who's actually going to win our medals this time if the swimmers aren't going to bail us out? And then I guess the media slowly realised that the sailors are going to bail us out. And we ended up winning 4 medals. And but when I won mine, I just couldn't believe the media attention it got. It was huge, and it was Australia's first individual gold medal. And it was a great moment. I don't necessarily like the media attention. But I was still pretty new to it all back then, but it was a pretty big moment. And at the Cove Inn after we'd won, and all the breakfast news TVs coming up to me and people handing me beers live TV and telling me to scull a beer on live morning TV. And I was young, I think I did most of it. So it was a wild time, but yeah, very, very fond memories.
It was Monday, the 6th of August, Tom, in case you've forgotten. I mean, but for a few days, almost exactly 10 years have passed now. A gold medal for a proud sporting nation. When you look back on it all, how did that time change the life of Tom Slingsby? What's it given you?
I guess for me, it just gave me confidence that I can do anything I want to do. And it's very cliche, but if you set your mind to something, there's nothing that can stop you. I'm not the most athletic. I'm probably not the most hardworking. I'm not the most professional. I'm not anything. I'm not a standout sort of athlete. But I know if I'm dedicated to something, nothing can stop me. And I think I've got that belief now from the Olympics that you can do anything you want to do. If I decide tomorrow that I want to quit sailing and start up motor racing, I truly believe that if I put in the work, I could go to very high levels of the sport. And I remember Ian Percy sort of saying something where he said, for the rest of your life, you'll walk into a room and people will point at you and go, that guy's a gold medalist. And it's kind of true. It just gives you confidence and like something to be proud of, that people will always sort of look at you and say, that guy did something amazing. And so for me, it's just a confidence thing. I know that I can do anything I want to do. And but right now, I don't want to change to motorsport. I don't want to change anything. I just love sailing, and I love all the different areas and aspects of the sport. We've got everything. You can race around the world. You can do the America's Cup, which is, and design the fastest boat you can think of. You can sail your little foiling dinghy in the Moth on Lake Garda, or you can do Sail GP, a traveling high performance racing at its best. You can do whatever you want to do. You can go back. I could go back to the Olympics and try for that. So many avenues in our sport. It's unlike any other sport. You know, we're not looking at a black line in the bottom of a pool every single day. We're just so lucky. And I'm 37, turning 38 very soon. And I've never loved the sport more than I do right now.
You didn't defend your medal. I mean, why not? That's quite unusual. Still young and more than capable of a solid defence. Why were you happy just to call it a day?
I would have been 27 years old in the London Games, and for sure, physically and mentally, I could definitely go for another Olympic campaign. I joined Oracle in 2011, and the agreement with Jimmy Spittel, who hired me, was at the end of the Olympics, you join us full time, and we do the America's Cup in 2013 together. I did that. I started that campaign, and I remember thinking, I'll finish this, and I'm going back into the Olympic world, and maybe I'll do both. And that was always the plan. And then we had the America's Cup, and we ended up winning in dramatic fashion.
We're going to get to
all
that.
Get to that. Yeah,
jumping ahead here. I mean, I'm curious now how that call went when Jimmy phoned you up and said, "Come on."
Yeah.
Come with me.
Well, I guess he called. I remember I was in Hamilton Island at the time, and we met, and I'd known him, and we were sort of friendly for a while. And then he said, "We need to talk about you joining our team." And at the same time, I don't know if they almost talk or something, but I got a call from Luna Rossa and Max Serena to come join their team. And I had a meeting with Jimmy, and he just said, "Look, these boats are getting faster and faster, becoming more athletic, and we're starting to realise that you need young, fit, fast-thinking sailors on board, and there's a bit of a new generation coming through with these fast catamarans. We know that you're a good laser sailor, and you're now sailing A-class dinghies and foiling moths. I think we need someone like you to join." And it didn't take me long to decide that I wanted to join Oracle Team USA, and I joined them. But I guess going back to the Olympics, I always planned to. I was always thinking I'll go do another one in lasers, or maybe I'll switch to the fin straight away, or laser and then a fin. But I got wrapped up in the America's Cup world, and after the 2013 Cup, I got another great offer with Oracle, and I just said, "Well, I'm going to do this for a while," and then shortly after, I realised that I don't think I have the time to do another Olympic campaign at 100%, and so many young, hungry athletes coming up, and I was like, I don't think I can dedicate enough time to do a successful defence, because I remember thinking to myself, I go and come away with a silver medal, which is an amazing, result. It'll still feel like a bit of a letdown. And so I decided not to return. And I also saw that the future of the laser class was in amazing hands with Blackers running it, and Matt Wern, Tom Burton coming through. They were leading, they were winning big major events in the laser class. And so I said, "Well, I don't want to go head to head with those guys. It's their time to shine. They deserve this opportunity." And then the fin class, I just didn't think I could put enough time and energy into it to be successful. So I never returned to the Olympics. I didn't plan on leaving like that, but that's the way it played out.
How big a leap is it from campaigning in a laser, you know, part of a team, but nothing like the mighty Team Oracle USA, and sailing on a 72-foot multi-hull? How big a change was it?
It was huge. It was crazy. I went from the laser at London, went home to Australia, did athlete parades. So I'm walking down the street sort of waving and people screaming my name and all sorts of weird things. And then I spent 1 week in Australia, and then I flew to San Francisco, and I was a nobody again, and I was one out of 165 people at Oracle Team USA. And I think it was a bit of a hazing at that time. I guess there was a bit of the old sort of Kiwi brigade in that team, in the sailors, and everyone was a bit of a, you're a rookie until you prove yourself here. And I remember I wasn't given any sailing time. The AC-72 was just out sailing, and I was allowed to sail the AC-45 occasionally. But in general, I remember arriving at Oracle at the end of August and got told, okay, you're going to be cleaning all the winches and you're going to be servicing winches and get used to it. And so I had to learn all that and learn about the boat. And I was basically a shore team member for the first couple of months. And yeah, it was a shock to the system. And if I'm honest, I nearly left in the first 3 or 4 months. I wasn't given the opportunity to sail. And I was sitting there thinking, why have you guys hired me? I'm a sailor, I'm good tactically, I'm fit, I'm young, and you guys have me sitting here cleaning winches for 9 hours a day. What are we doing here? And if it wasn't for a few people, probably namely Joey Newton and Dirk De Ritter, there's a good chance I would have left that team. I just remember thinking, well, I can go back to Australia. I can earn money now. People know who I am. I can start another Olympic campaign and do a good job and just carry on. Over here, I'm nobody, and I'm not getting to sail. But a few of the, Joey Newton and Dirk De Ritter said, look, they're being a bit harsh on you at the moment. It's all part of a bit of a hazing period here at Oracle, and don't worry, it'll get better, and just ride out these next few months and you'll get your sailing time, don't worry. And so I end up sticking to it, and yeah, I'm happy I did.
The build up to San Francisco was a very exciting time in the sport, wasn't it? I mean, there was the World Series, as you mentioned, on smaller multi-hulls, but also all the chat of foiling 72-foot cup boats. I mean, what did you think when the decision was made to go with foils? And there's that whole story also when we first saw the Kiwis glimpse that they were foiling. I mean, what was that like then? What did you think about it?
I remember, well, yeah, at the time when I had joined Oracle, we didn't know that it was going to be foiling. I remember them talking about how these boats might go 30 knots downwind. And I remember thinking, that's crazy. 30 knots downwind and 20 knots upwind. They were saying these boats will be capable of. And I remember thinking, oh, that's crazy. We've never seen that. Even the 100-foot trimaran didn't do that speed. So this is insane. And then when I joined the Cup and we started campaigning for Oracle, I still remember seeing that first photo of Team New Zealand and it just being put up on the big screen at Oracle in our meeting room and everyone going through it trying to figure out how they've photoshopped this. This can't be right. It's not real. Like, you can't put a 72-foot boat in the air. We were going down the line of really, I guess, foil assisted, and you could maybe skim and you might pop up for little periods of time, but at that time no one was able to foil a boat stable on, put a foiling catamaran stably on foils. And this boat was just, it kind of looked like a computer generated thing, where it was foiling and the boat wasn't going up or down, it wasn't crashing down, it was perfectly foiling along the Hauraki Gulf. And we're like, is this real? And then I'm not sure who it was. We had a spy down in New Zealand. They said, it's real. I've seen it. They're going downwind at over 30 knots, straight line VMG downwind, and you guys have got a bit on. And that was a shock to the system, and all of a sudden all the designers and everyone at Oracle had a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment. How are we going to counter this? And we were fortunate, we were on that path, we just hadn't figured out how to do it stably. But then began the whole game of, let's copy and try to improve. And yeah, we copied the hell out of them, and that's what we had to do. And our spies, I guess, worked overtime for the next 9 months trying to figure out every little thing they're doing and how they're doing it.
That's a cop, isn't it? You never stop. I mean, famously, of course, Oracle's first boat ended up upside down, floating under the San Francisco Bridge. I mean, Jimmy talks about it in depth in an earlier edition of the podcast, about how responsible he felt. What are your memories of that day? And, you know, how much did that really impact the whole thing?
Well, as I said earlier, I wasn't allowed on the boat. And the start of October 2012, I got my first sail on the boat as a guest for maybe five, 10 minutes. I was a guest in the middle of on the trampoline. And then my first day of sailing on the boat was the day we capsized. And funnily enough, I was, I replaced JK probably an hour and a half before the capsize. And so this is my first day on the boat, and I'm on as a tactician. I'm in awe of everyone. Jimmy Spittle's like a god, and or the whole team are the who's who of sailing. And then they're saying, okay, Tom, what do you want to do here? Well, what do you think? Should we go up, wind, downwind? What do you want to work on? And I'm like, and I'm just saying whatever I think everyone, they want me to say. And I remember we were going up and we were foiling downwind by this stage, and it was really unstable foiling. We did not have control of that boat, but we sort of were able to wobble down each time and go, okay, that might have been a little bit better. We only crashed 5 times on that downwind compared to 7 the run before. We're getting there. And then we're at the bottom and it was really picking up. It was the biggest ebb tide of the year. Really, it's probably 25 knots plus at this stage, and probably a 5 knot current going against the wind. The waves were big. And then I realized that and then Jimmy said to me, he said, what do you think? Should we do one more lap? And I remember thinking, I don't want to be the guy who says no. I was really scared, but I didn't want to show Jimmy that I was scared. And so I said, yep, sure, let's go again. Hey, everyone, we're going to do one more lap. And I still remember some people looking back at me. I remember John O'Macbeth actually looking back and just with his eyes like, are you sure? And I remember going, oh, am I doing the wrong thing here? But I just didn't want to look like I was scared. So I said, yeah, let's go one more lap. Let's do it. And on that upwind, it picked up again. It was probably in the high 20 knots. And every other boat on the San Francisco Bay, little yachts and everything, had all scattered by this stage. It was too windy. And we're out there in a 72-foot half-foiling cat that we had just launched and didn't really know how to control. And halfway up, we realized that this is getting really windy. And Jimmy said, I think it's getting too windy. We should probably turn back. And I said, yeah, I agree. And we went into the bearaway. And as you saw, we went down, huge pitch pole. And it was just a scramble from then. It's all a bit of a blur. But all I remember from that was Jimmy saying, hold on and look after your mates. And then I remember dangling. I was very lucky, actually. I was sharing a cockpit with Brian McGuinness, known as Puck. And he's probably 115 kilos. And we were doing the bearaway. And that day, Cheese, our wing trimmer, had said, look, you keep grinding the wing on until I tell you to stop. And I remember bearing away and I was facing backwards. I remember looking down at the leeward runner and going, geez, the leeward rudder is about to pop out of the water here. And it came out of the water and I just kept grinding. I was like, I'm not going to stop until I didn't know the characteristics of the boat. Does grinding on more bring the hull back into the water? So I just kept grinding. And then sure enough, I realized where this isn't right. We're getting higher and higher. And so I turned around and realized what was going on. And Puck dropped and grabbed the pedestal. And Jimmy said, everyone hold on. And Puck, this huge man, just dropped down and grabbed the pedestal. And I was a bit late. I dropped down and tried to get in there, but I just couldn't get a grip. And so I held onto the handles of the grinding pedestal. And as the impact hit and we were over 90 degrees, I remember my legs went flying out of the cockpit and I was dangling, holding onto the handles, the roller handles of the grinding pedestal, and swinging around. And I thought I was a goner. I didn't know what was going to happen. It's all adrenaline. But I managed to swing in and get my feet on Jimmy's back, and he sort of pulled me into the cockpit. And we didn't know what was going to happen. Was the wing going to break? Was it going to snap and we had to get out of there? We didn't know anything, but it was super scary time. But Jimmy, then and there, I realized how amazing a leader he was. He was saying, okay, everyone relax. Is everyone okay? Is everyone safe? Okay. And then we started hearing all the cracking of all the flaps in the wing. And then I think Jimmy or someone said, we've got to get out of here. This wing's going to snap. Everyone get off as quick as you can. And so we're all sort of trying to climb down to the front of the boat where we can jump in, because we couldn't just jump off, because we have a windward foil up, which is like a razor blade. If you've ever felt one of these foils, it's got a titanium trailing edge, which is, if you just run your finger along, you can cut your finger. And if we jumped, we would hit the windward foil. So we all had to climb down the net and then jump into the water. And yeah, it was a blur, and then it just escalated. The boat started disintegrating, breaking apart, and getting pulled out underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. And oh, what an ordeal for my first day sailing the boat.
That's a great tale. I hadn't realised it was your fault, Tom.
Yeah, it was my fault, I think. If I said, no, it's too windy, we should... And to this, right now, I'd sit there and say, no, this is stupid. Like, let's turn around. It's not worth risking the boat or the people here. Let's turn around. But at that time, it was a perfect storm. I wanted to be shown that I can be taken for real. These guys hadn't given me a day on the sailing boat yet. I got to show that I'm not scared. And it escalated into me making a pretty bad call. I never got the blame for it. Jimmy always took the blame, said I should have turned us around there. But for sure, I played a part.
We're going to leave Tom there, a young Aussie sailor enjoying his first big America's Cup experience, watching a multi-million dollar foiling multi-hull getting ripped through the infamous currents under the Golden Gate Bridge and out into the Pacific Ocean, all the while thinking it was his fault. If you've not listened to Jimmy Spittle's edition of this podcast, maybe go back and give it a listen later. He tells the same story from his perspective and does, as Tom says, accept full responsibility for it. He even discusses the rather awkward phone call with Larry Ellison that followed. To Tom, of course, a massive thanks for his time. As you may imagine, Tom's schedule is pretty hectic. It's taken a while to sit down and chat, but it's definitely been worth the wait. Tom, thank you. If you've enjoyed the podcast and you'd like to support us, then please do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. We work hard to bring you this quality ad-free listen. It takes a lot of time and work, so it's lovely to have your support. Many, many thanks for that. And thanks too to the untiring enthusiasm and energy of the very talented Tim at Vertigo Films for producing these podcasts. Tim has very fond memories of filming all the celebrations and interviews at the Cove Inn in Portland as the Aussie sailing team racked up their gold medals at London 2012. After a day filming on the water, we'd often end up filming there in the evening. It felt like a very special moment for many people. And so that's us. Do tune in to part two with Tom. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water. And sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Blackout is on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho, ho, ho. That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the daylight there.
We're looking at 10.5 to 42. Matching him on the boundary, yeah. Copy.
Castle One standing by. Out.